My title was anonymization, but I think the better title would be tension, because I'm not going to talk about anonymization. It's been covered better than I could possibly cover it. And so in the goal of non-anonymization, this is my genetic profile. And as you can see, the number one elevated risk I carry genetically based on my individual genetic variation is a significantly elevated risk of prostate cancer. And there's a tension between how easy it is to generate this information and how difficult it is for this information to be useful. So the classic thing up until a couple of years ago to do is to go get a prostate-specific antigen test to look for a certain kind of marker in my blood. And based on my age and the amount of that biomarker, then I would be shuttled into the medical industrial system to be biopsied and get all sorts of other sorts of treatments. And this is the best test we have to find out if there's a cancer inside the prostate. There are other kinds of more classic sort of stereotypical ways to look, but realistically, if you want to figure out what's going on inside the gland, this is your best bet. Unfortunately, what we're finding is the PSA test has extremely high false positives. The biopsies have serious odds of having negative side effects. And the overwhelming consensus, I've talked to at least 10 doctors, including the head of a major clinical system, and this is the only consensus advice I have received. So, you know, here I know something about my genome that was not knowable 5 to 10 years ago, and there's no utility for me in my health. And one of the reasons for this is that we arrived at the PSA test, and it was taken through the FDA based on classic randomized controlled trials and sample sizes in a mathematical approach of frequentism, not of statistical inference, because we don't have sample sizes. The sample size required to get a diagnostic or a drug through the FDA would never fly to change an advertising algorithm at Facebook, which is really depressing. Okay, so that's tension number one. So how do we get a larger group? I was asked to talk briefly about crowdsourcing. And so I distinguish this into two things. So there's crowds of data users, right? The finest minds of our generation, as Jeff Hammerbacher, who was the first data scientist at Facebook, came up with this quote, "The finest minds of my generation are obsessed with making people click on advertising, and that sucks." Right? And this is what they do, right? They build these Bayesian statistical networks and these inference systems, and a lot of them don't like what they do. So how do we attract them to come work on taking large amounts of genetic variation and large amounts of health-reported outcomes like, I'm 41 and I don't yet have prostate cancer, and figure out what it is that takes 10,000 men and their genotypes who do and don't have prostate cancer and find clusters of genetic variations that appear to be indicative of early onset prostate, late onset prostate, non-aggressive prostate, aggressive prostate, right? This sort of requires that we not add noise to the data. It's one of the fundamental tensions is that the methods that provide consumer privacy defeat the utility of these methods in health, because it's precisely the accuracy of the data that's essential to know which variations are actually causing the health outcomes versus the ones that are not causing the health outcomes. So at SAGE, which is a nonprofit where I spend about half of my time, we decided to test out, could we attract teams of these data scientists? They're the highest paid people in the world, if you believe McKinsey and other sorts of searches. We were able to get more than 1,000 data scientists in more than 150 teams in more than 50 countries to come work on public data. It was women who had been treated for breast cancer and then relapsed. And we knew the outcomes, but the people competing didn't. So the idea was, and we used existing public data as the training set, and we actually genotyped 200 women de novo, where we had novel sequences that had never been studied before. And what we found was that we could get the algorithms to 77% accuracy in prediction. And the winning team was not a biological group. It was an electrical engineering group that had been blown off by the local cancer group because they didn't know what they were talking about. And the only incentive we put out there was first author publication in Science Translational Medicine without peer review. By winning the contest, you got waived through peer review. And just with this, we were able to get to that level of accuracy. And the sample size is still in the small, like 700-800 women. And what we're doing now is trying to blow that number out to 10 to 15,000 under the belief that with a larger sample size, these methods work better. We can get closer and closer to a 90 to 95% chance of saying, we have no idea why, but based on the following group of variations, if we were to genotype an individual, we could predict with relative confidence whether or not she's likely to be at risk for a relapse and therefore adjust her health, right? More frequent visits to the doctor and so forth. Right, now that is the tension between anonymity and utility, which Paul Ohm has laid out. I would encourage you to just Google Ohm, privacy, utility, you'll find it. And we have to deal with this now as a provider because we're trying to encourage people to host their data sets on our platform and run these sorts of challenges. So we've had to create an entire set of training materials to train the data users. Because if you're going to expand the universe of data users beyond those who've been trained in human subjects protection, most of them have never dealt with an IRB, right? They've been raised on social data inside the walls of companies that don't consider it protected at all. So we have to actually teach people as they're showing up what it means to deal with open data, restricted data, and controlled data. Crowdsourcing sort of also implies crowds of data donors. And this is what I spend most of my time on, is how do we build systems that let people donate their data to science if the data is inherently not going to be scrambled? This takes the form of informed consent. It also means you run into massive tensions between what people think is happening in clinical data and what's actually happening in clinical data. So this is an article from this August asking people what their preferences and expectations were for secondary use of their electronic health information. So 68% in the article said they were okay with sharing in a university research context. I can guarantee you 68% of data is not shared. Right, it's like maybe two orders of magnitude lower. Right, 0.68% of data gets shared, and the primary fig leaf that people hide behind is informed consent, as from a PI perspective. And I've dealt with enough IRBs and enough data scientists and enough friends. This is the first consent form, at least that's archivable. It was from the some of the yellow fever experiments in Cuba, and they paid these folks, but they told them, you know, you might die. Right. But we'll find out whether or not mosquitoes carry yellow fever or it's this magical thing called fomites, and of course it turned out to be mosquitoes. The lack of informed consent documents that actually foresee secondary use in research is the primary justification for blocking the reuse of data in an institutional context. So we've had to build a novel kind of consent system for donating your data to research. So it's an asymmetric system, you log in, you click, you say, I'd like to give these four rights. It's not modular, you have to click all of them. Then you can proceed, you have to watch a video. It's all of 7 minutes long. We lose 87% of our participants during the 7 minute video. We don't know whether that's because 7 minutes is too long in a YouTube world or we've scared them out of the project. But the goal is not to sucker people in. We want them to come in with their eyes open because the idea is you are re-identifiable. We will introduce friction. We'll introduce norms, we'll introduce terms of use and contracts, but by signing up for this to accelerate it, you are trading a certain amount of your guarantee of confidentiality or anonymization. Then you have to click three more times, I understand the uncertainty and the risk, I provide consent, I understand although I can withdraw, I can't withdraw if it's been distributed. If someone has made an FDA filing based on the data, we're not going to be able to go delete it from the FDA's archives. This is part of the reality of biomedical versus other kinds of research. Now, we did a couple of tests. Like this is, I've shortened the e-consent process, but do people understand the consent? At least on first blush, they appear to understand the consent. They choose the data they upload. They can decide to withdraw. But even if they withdraw, we can't guarantee the data will be deleted from the system. Depressingly, the one place where we didn't get the massive results we liked was on guarantee of confidentiality. Now, I have a different question that has a much better result, which is where we're going to do our best, and they understood that. But we only got about 60% understanding that there is no guarantee, and that's what we're reworking in the IRB, the next IRB filing. So then the other question is, well, what happens if you've gone through the consent process and you can donate your data to research? So again, I'm my own guinea pig. So I took the genotype that I showed you. This is what it looks like inside our system. As you can see, I've been assigned an opaque identifier, although, as Dan pointed out, it doesn't help very much, and I'll show you evidence of that. So because my genotype was here, it got syndicated over to a wiki called OpenSNP. They were able to find my handle, JTW. It's my middle initial is T. I have very little privacy at this point. So this gets syndicated then to a wiki, a different wiki called SNPedia that automatically contacts you and sends you a health report. Now, I'm able to know that the first result, the bad repute, means that I shouldn't trust it. but I've shown this in an informal survey to quite a few people who think that bad repute means that the result is bad for me. Right? So there's a gradient of understanding of how to interpret probabilistic results that is missing in the population. So the hypertension, bad repute, that's good. And then the won't go bald thing is good repute, so that's really good. And then it gets syndicated from there to, there's a genealogist who does genetic genealogy in the UK who ran an allele variation on me and then sent me an email with the following sentence. Right. So, I mean, but think about this in the context of anonymization and utility and reuse, which is that it's very hard for me to get a health benefit from talking about my genome to with my doctor, which is why I should use it. But and for most of us, when we can't find something from the experts, we go to the internet, and this is what comes back from the internet. So we're in a moment where there's this real tension where the privacy conversation is being driven by Snowden. But the mathematics that identify you in the Snowden world are the mathematics that will stratify us effectively in a health context. And so we're sort of creating these tracks where the institutional health world is clamping down, right, because of informed consent and IRBs and other sorts of systems. The popular dialogue is moving towards disabling the mathematics that will drive personalized medicine. And the policy debate is basically 10 years behind all of this. And I don't have a good answer, right? I just point out that what I showed you with the genotype, right, this is what's happening with your phone. So this is the device that turns your phone into an ECG. You can actually do heart rate and blood pressure just from the camera. You can diagnose Parkinson's from the altimeter, the GPS, the accelerometer, and the voice. Right? These things are becoming medical devices that are completely regulated outside the context of what Deborah was talking about, because they're not considered health information, although we can infer anything we want. And if you don't believe me, I'll leave you with an anecdote. It's one of my favorite ones. I have a friend who was at medical school studying alcoholism who wanted to figure out how many kids on campus drank after midnight on weeknights. Now, he went through his IRB, tried to file a survey, took him 4 or 5 months, and he finally realized that college students disproportionately drink out of red Solo cups. And they're on Facebook, and they're drunk posting photographs, and they have typos in the caption. So it's very easy to set up an algorithm that looks for the RGB code. It's a very, very clear RGB and Pantone code for red Solo cups. You cross-reference that to the time of posting, look for typos, do it by the day of the week, and you have basically turned a cultural artifact into a health data point. So as we do this conversation about anonymization, utility, policy, like remember that locking down the clinical data that I showed you irresponsibly, some would tell you, in the first part of this presentation, right, isn't going to stop the inference of health out of all of this unregulated information. And banking on anonymization and utility systems that add noise actually defeats, in many ways, the utility of tying genetic variation to health outcomes, which is sort of the promise of personalized medicine. So we're going to have to find a way to resolve that, given LaTanya's probably most famous quote, which is, we are not as anonymous as we thought we were. It just cost too much to figure out who we were, and it doesn't anymore. I'll stop there.
Thanks, John.